This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on war-torn Yemen. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It's been 5 years since a Saudi-led coalition invaded neighboring Yemen at the request of Yemen's government. The goal of the intervention was to topple the Houthi, who had seized the capital Sana'a a few months earlier. Despite having their own grievances against the predominantly Sunni elite, the Houthi gradually grew closer to Iran, which in turn has enlisted the group as a part of their so-called axis of resistance, which includes Syria, Lebanese Hezbollah, and some Iraqi Shiite militias. According to one of our Encounter guests, Catherine Zimmerman, quote, Iran leverages this alliance to pursue objectives that include expelling the United States from the Middle East and establishing Iranian regional hegemony, unquote. 5 years on, Zimmerman says that, quote, the Saudi-led intervention transformed the Yemeni conflict by entangling it in regional conflicts. So what started out as a post-Arab Spring political crisis in 2011 over the transition of power became another theater for the Saudi-Iranian proxy conflict, unquote. A nation of approximately 30 million people, Yemen is among the world's poorest countries. According to the New York-based Soufan Center, nearly 8 out of 10 Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. In Yemen, hundreds of people are now dying from coronavirus-like symptoms. The Soufan Center says nobody knows exactly how bad the pandemic is or how bad it may get. In her recent testimony before the House of Representatives Subcommittee on the Middle East, North Africa, and International Terrorism, Catherine Zimmerman said the United States has vital security interests in Yemen. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, retains a safe haven there, and it is one of the terrorist groups most focused on attacking the U.S. homeland. Well, for more on the roots and implications of the crisis in Yemen and what it would take to bring the conflict to an end are two distinguished analysts. Ambassador Stephen Sesh is Executive Vice President of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Prior to his position at that institute, Ambassador Sesh had a distinguished 35-year career in the U.S. Foreign Service. He was U.S. Ambassador to Yemen from 2007 to 2010 and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the Department of State. And Catherine Zimmerman, whom I quoted in the introduction, she's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where she focuses on terror groups, including the Salafi Jihadi movement and the global Al-Qaeda network. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing in the age of the coronavirus pandemic. Ambassador Sesh, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Carol. Pleasure to be with you again.
And I'm also delighted to welcome Catherine Zimmerman.
It's good to be here virtually with you, Carol.
Well, Catherine, ladies first, let's just remind our audience what's at stake in Yemen, not just for Yemen and the region, but the world. Why should we care?
The reason why the world cares about Yemen is frankly where it sits in the world. It is geostrategically located along the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and that's one of the world's few maritime choke points. So when you're looking at international commerce, who controls the Bab el-Mandeb starts to influence who has influence over global commercial activity, especially maritime activity. For the rest of the world, we also have questions of terrorism, the unrest that's spreading out of Yemen, and the destabilization of the Arabian Peninsula. So what it has done to American Gulf state partners, especially Saudi Arabia, do impact the rest of the international community. And alarmingly, we're looking at the humanitarian conditions, which are terrible inside of Yemen, but have remained, frankly, contained inside of the country, which is why so much of the world doesn't care about what is happening in that country.
So turning to you, Ambassador Sesh, you know the country very well. You served as ambassador. I admire the culture, the resilience of the people. It's an amazing place. Tell us what you have to add to what Catherine said.
Well, I certainly think in addition to what Katie has noted, which is the Bab el-Mandeb and, 6 million barrels of oil and refined petroleum products go through that strait every day. In addition, stability in Saudi Arabia is critically important. AQAP as a threat to United States and Western interests based in Yemen is a threat. And I think also as a nation, we cannot ignore the humanitarian crisis that has just seized Yemen and has now racked the country with all kinds of disease and cholera and dengue and malnutrition and children dying because they're food insecure and they're starving. And now you have COVID-19 on top of that. Then the de facto authorities in Yemen, the Houthis, are mismanaging that terribly for their own particular political gain and interest. So there is a real imperative here, I think, for the world to not stray away and not get tired and not get weary of the bad news coming out of Yemen, but continue to insist that the authorities in Yemen and the parties to the conflict start to act like adults and stop pursuing their own narrowly defined interests and see that there's a larger interest at stake. And that is, in many ways, it's humanitarian, it's geopolitical, as Katie said. There's a lot of dimensions, all of which cry out for attention.
Speaking of parties to the conflict, turning back to you, Catherine Zimmerman, remind us what the underlying grievances are that led to this conflict in the first place.
The underlying grievances in Yemen, just to sum them up, are basically Yemen is a country that has very, very few resources. When we're talking about Yemen, it's in the Middle East, it's an Arab country, but it doesn't match the resources of the rest of the Arab Gulf states in particular. And its demographics more closely mirror those of sub-Saharan Africa. And so it has few resources. And then the government before the Arab Spring, and I would say, frankly, the government and the de facto authorities today have mismanaged the distribution of those resources. So there are many people in that country who feel as though they are owed more than what the government's giving, and they see a very few with plenty. So there's significant economic and political marginalization that's occurred over Yemen's history, and even in the past decade, steps that have nominally been taken to resolve these grievances have not actually resulted in the change that the population has demanded.
And Ambassador Sesh, I'd like you to add to that, particularly the Houthis, what they want and how they managed to basically gain control of the capital and are still there entrenched, notwithstanding all the bombing and attempts by the Saudi-led coalition to displace them.
Well, Carol, the Houthis have fundamentally been engaged in armed conflict in Yemen now for 16 years. So going back to 2004, when, as Katie said, the previous government of Ali Abdullah Saleh, now deceased, when they had a series of six conflicts with him, internal conflicts, ended in 2010. Then you had the Arab Spring 2011 and 2013 with a lot of civil unrest there, which also included the Houthis during that time. And then subsequently down into 2013 and 14, the Houthis slowly made their way into the capital, Sana'a, where they did seize the reins of government in September 2014 and continued on and really began to occupy large swaths of the country, much to the alarm of their neighbors, who suddenly saw this tip of the Iranian spear moving itself around the country with impunity. And I think that's a misrepresentation, but that was the anxiety that provoked Riyadh to respond the way it did. So the Houthis are now, after this long a period of time of being a armed militia, are battle-hardened. They're very well-trained. They're determined. And they're homegrown. I mean, this is an insurgency that is born out of grievance, and it may be now morphing into other claims. But I do think that there is a genuine need to address the grievances that lie at the root of the Houthi militia and the Houthi movement itself.
Turning back to you, Katie Zimmerman, talking about the Houthis, they are not alien to Yemen. It's a movement, as I understand, that has centered its belief system on the Zaydi branch of Islam. That's a sect of Islam almost exclusively present in Yemen. The Zaydis make up, 25% of the population. The Sunnis make up 75%. I think that's important that we make these distinctions because some people don't understand. They think Houthi, Iran. But you have said in many of your writings that there is an alliance, but it's really the Iranians who are taking advantage of the Houthi. Is that correct? Talk about that proxy conflict.
The relationship between the Houthis and Iran, I think, is actually a mutually beneficial one at this point, which is why it's been so solid. The Houthis are indigenous, as you note. They come from the Zaydi Shia population, which does account for about 40%, but the Houthis don't represent all of the Zaydi Shia inside of Yemen. And that's something that gets missed. This isn't a sectarian war in the country. And it's not as though Yemen had sectarianism before the conflict today. What we're seeing actually come forward from the Houthi authorities are sectarian policies and kind of an increasing move to institute religious reforms in Yemen in the areas that they control. When we're looking at what Iran is getting out of the relationship, Iran is putting in very, very limited assistance, especially when you compare with the Iranians have given the Houthis to what the Iranians originally gave Lebanese Hezbollah or the Iranians, how they've effectively supported the Assad regime in Syria at great cost to the Iranian regime back at home. If you look at the Iranian protests that have been occurring over the past year, the Iranians are only putting in the types of weapon systems that the Houthis need to gain an asymmetrical advantage against Saudi Arabia. And this has been the big inflection from Iran, has been the introduction of UAVs, so drones that the Houthis can fly across the border that are very difficult for the Saudis and frankly even the US military to detect and thwart before they strike. Cruise missiles and ballistic missiles that the Houthis can launch from within their territory, and also the ability to project force back into the Red Sea on Yemen's western coast. The Iranians, of course, provide the Houthis with a slew of other options, diplomatic support. They've built up the Houthi media organization. There have been great changes in how the Houthis and their propaganda and framing of the conflict have developed over the past 5 years in particular, as well as, I think, the strategic advice. So we know that the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force, the IRGC, has individuals inside of Yemen that are advising the Houthis. We assess that there are Hezbollahis, so Lebanese Hezbollah, there as well. And the training that the Houthis have received has helped improve their capabilities. But as Steve noted earlier, the Houthis have fought previous to this. So they had 6 years of war to cut their teeth, and that actually hardened them militarily before the current conflict.
Ambassador Sesh, feel free to add anything you'd like to the Iranian Houthi alliance, but we're also going forward and seeing that the Saudis pulled out. If I'm not mistaken, you might talk about the fact that they have retreated, the UAE, one of their partners. And now we're seeing in the South, the Southern Transitional Council, that they have declared sort of an autonomous zone. So the conflict has really splintered and become even more amorphous and perhaps more dangerous.
I think that's right, Carol. I think it has become more dangerous and more fractured, as you note. And I think that it is very difficult now to, with any real certainty, identify who's on whose side anymore, because everyone is claiming their own privilege, their own ambitions, their own playbook. And very often, this does not even sync with any others who are ostensibly partners or allies of theirs. So you're seeing, I think, as kind of the sense grows that the Saudis really do want to get out of Yemen as quickly as possible and relieve themselves of this terrible mess that they've waded into, everyone kind of says, well, now it's time for us to claim our bit of territory, our bit of political influence, our bit of what's going to be the future of this country. And it's each person, each organization, each clan, each tribe for themselves. And so this does make for a terrible landscape to try to work with in a rational form. And certainly we have seen the coalition that the Saudis have been ostensibly leading in Yemen a year ago now, the Emiratis decided they were done, that peace was almost at hand, their mission was accomplished, and they could go home. And so they withdrew the bulk of their combat forces. But their influence remains, and it remains largely with, as you note, the Southern Transitional Council. And they have trained enormous numbers of fighters who are loyal to the STC, this Transitional Council, which is a very secessionist-minded organization, and it has made very clear its determination to remove itself from under the authority of the central government. So there are implications for what these external forces have done to Yemen, which complicate the ability of Yemenis themselves to resolve the conflict in a way they might wish to.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Stephen Sesh, from whom you just heard. He's former ambassador to Yemen, now executive vice president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Catherine Zimmerman. She's resident fellow and critical threats project advisor at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a Washington-based think tank. We're discussing the geopolitical situation in war-torn Yemen and prospects for stability. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower, Biziriko Gay Kennedy from Burundi. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please leave a comment on our Facebook page or send us an email to encounter at voanews.com. Back to you, Catherine. Let's take a look at briefly the Southern movement, the secessionist movement. Where do they stand among all these alliances? And if you want to talk a little bit more about the UAE's role, how they've been helpful with counterterrorism, but also perhaps have helped to provoke some of these splinterings.
Well, Carol, as Steve alluded to, the Southern movement has as part of it, a governing body called the Southern Transitional Council, the STC, which represents some of the Southerners. And I think that's something that, again, gets missed. But the conflict itself is so fractious. When we're talking about Yemen South, it's not a single block. And when we're talking about Southern secessionists or Southerners advocating for their rights, again, it's not a single block. But the STC is the body that is problematic currently for the government that the United States recognizes inside of Yemen, because the STC has made moves to declare itself the de facto authority inside of Aden, the previous capital of South Yemen, and also the capital where the government now sits in Yemen. And it has received significant support from the UAE, as well as support from a lot of the security forces that the UAE has trained up over the past few years. So when the UAE began a counterterrorism offensive in Yemen in 2016, it did so by using local Yemenis. It's trained thousands of Yemenis and armed them as well, given them the ability to organize on the ground and backed them with money. And these forces helped, of course, in the counterterrorism offensive against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. And as an analyst, I have to say, I've been looking at that Al-Qaeda group now for over a decade, and it has not been so disrupted or degraded before. And so when we're talking about what's going on, there is, I guess, a bright side in this, and that the counterterrorism side of Yemen has been relatively effective. There are a lot of warnings about what might come of that. But in terms of that network and organization, it is much, much weaker. And we have to thank our Emirati partners for that. How they did it is what we need to be concerned about, because that's what's set Yemen up for a series of conflicts, which are both armed and political. The current conflict that's happening in the south is over the future of southern Yemen. So, as I mentioned earlier, the country's resources have never been divided fairly. There are a lot of grievances against the government. Southern Yemenis fought a civil war against the northern government in 1994. They lost. They never received reparations. Their military forces were removed without pension. There are historical grievances that these individuals are tapping into, and they want to see some sort of self-rule. They believe that they're owed more resources, and it doesn't hurt that the few oil resources in the country are actually located within parts of southern territory. So there's this idea that if they can just get rid of the northern bits of Yemen, they actually have a lot more to offer their people. But they are actively looking to shape the outcome of Yemen's civil war and what comes next today. And it's causing a lot of unrest. And so when we're talking about the civil war, we tend to think of it in terms of the Houthis versus the Yemeni government. And when Yemenis talk about the civil war, they certainly frame it there, but they also recognize that the Yemeni government itself isn't unified, that the Southerners are not unified, and that all of the various groups that we're talking about are angling for different aspects and a different future in Yemen. And that's when the external meddling becomes such a problem, because when we're looking at the Saudi-led coalition, it breaks down in terms of who they're supporting on the ground. The Saudis are supporting one faction more than the other. The Emiratis tend to support the Southerners a little bit more. And there are now rumors the Turks and the Qataris playing some games in parts of Yemen, trying to prop up some Muslim Brotherhood type figures. All of this adds to the complexity of how do we resolve this conflict in a way that Yemenis accept. And I think that's one of the challenges, is when you look at what has been done to resolve the conflicts in Yemen, it's focused almost entirely on the one with the Houthis, to the detriment of resolving the underlying issues that the Houthis are part of, but that remain. So the opposition that formed in 2011 against the government wasn't just because of the Houthi movement, but the Southerners were involved. There were popular protests. None of those grievances have been resolved. They've been let to simmer. And the international process is really only focused on resolving the Houthi-Yemeni government conflict and then moving on to resolve the other ones, which is a problem when all those other actors are looking to get their share of the pie today.
Well, Ambassador Sesh, we're going to turn to you to solve the problem in the sense that, of course, you've been there. You have your finger on the pulse of all these different parties. What do we do at this point? I mean, what's the role of the UN, the special envoy, Martin Griffiths? Does he have any leverage? I wanted to get your take on where we stand today, given all these splintered groups and the withdrawal of the Saudis, UAE.
Well, that's a heck of a question, Carol. But I'll tell you, I do think that Martin Griffiths and the UN certainly have a role to, and he's trying his best to try to bring, as Katie said, the principal, perhaps, antagonists, the Houthis, together with the Yemeni government of President Hadi and the Saudis, and try to at least work out some kind of a script by which they can agree to proceed away from the battlefield into the negotiations. And so he's doing that. But that does not, again, and Katie's right about this, there's a large war and there's a lot of little wars that are just down below the surface that is not seen. And that's not part of what Martin Griffiths has been doing. And the construct that was supposed to be addressing some of these more localized, more internal Yemeni conflicts was this Stockholm Agreement that was signed, which was supposed to demilitarize the Port Hodeida, and that's fairly well collapsed. And then last November, there was the Riyadh Agreement that was supposed to bring the Hadi government back into some kind of a sync with the Southerners, and that's all but collapsed now as well. And the Saudis are scrambling, trying to resurrect that, I see today. But whether this can be done, I don't know. And I think this is the problem. The Saudis know they need to get out. They haven't got a clue how to do so, any more than they had a clue really what they were going to do when I get in there 5 years ago. So they need some help. And the United States is in the best position to sit with them and say, here's the steps that we think you need to take now. And I don't think we're doing that actively enough. I do think we've walked away from that responsibility. So absent that leadership on our part, I think the Saudis are left to their own devices. The Emiratis are, as Katie said, it's an invitation for other external players to come in and see what they can do. And everyone has a different solution up their sleeve. And they all benefit their particular interests and do not benefit the nation of Yemen or the people who have suffered for so long because of the mismanagement and the corruption and the inability to put rulers in place who can see a larger picture of how you get a nation back on its feet. So it's going to take a real concerted effort by external players working towards a common good. And that's not yet been, in my mind, clarified by all the external players.
And back to you, Catherine Zimmerman. You said in your testimony before Capitol Hill that the United States does indeed bear some responsibility for the conditions in Yemen. I'm quoting you. You said the U.S. subcontracted the protection of its interests to Gulf partners under the Obama administration while the U.S. pursued the Iranian nuclear deal. That's very perspicacious of you to say that. But nonetheless, here we are. The Trump administration obviously is busy with so many other crises. But on the other hand, as you both have underscored, there's a lot at stake in Yemen. What should the United States do? Do you think there is political will to do something at this point?
Well, Carol, there's no easy answer in Yemen, and so there is no real will to solve the challenges inside of Yemen. I think that the U.S. needs to press harder for the international community to recognize that we can't simply follow the UN blueprint to success because we've been trying that for the past 5 years. And Martin Griffiths certainly has put in a lot of work. He's had achievements. He's at least mitigated some of the humanitarian consequences of this war. But we're no closer to a successful resolution of the conflict today than we were when he started. I think that the other challenges we have is we want to turn back the clock. We want to get Yemen back to how it was in 2014 before the war really kicked off. And to do that ignores the fact that these problems existed then. So when we're talking about how to go forward, I think the realistic thing is to start to chart a course for Yemen that actually will start to address the issues that all of the actors are bringing up. I don't quite see how we get a resolution of the war currently because of the strength, frankly, that the Houthis have in Sana'a. And the fact that the opposing factions do not want the Houthis to have the amount of control and power that they will inevitably have. But there are baby steps that we can be taking. Convening of the international actors, ensuring that our Gulf partners are acting together rather than assuming that because we have largely aligned interests that the Gulf partners will take the same approach. And the other side of this is actually holding all actors accountable, both sides of the conflict, for what is going on. I think there's been some one-sided reporting as people want to blame either Saudi Arabia for the conflicts in Yemen, which if the Saudis pulled out of Yemen, we would still have a mess. It wouldn't resolve the conflict. Or even just blaming the Houthis, who have legitimate grievances, but have committed human rights violations, which need to be called out as well. So I think when we're talking about how to move forward in Yemen, it's looking to what Yemen can be rather than looking at what Yemen was.
That's just about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Ambassador Stephen Sesh. He's Executive Vice President of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Catherine Zimmerman, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.